It's the NPR Politics Podcast, here with our weekly roundup of political news. This week, we're going to play a little game. Going to see how long we can go without talking about Donald Trump. Let's see how that goes. And we're going to talk about what's happening on the Democratic side of the race with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. As always, we'll end the show with Can't Let It Go, where each of us shares something we just can't stop thinking about. Spoiler, someone's going to talk about Michelle Obama's new rap video. First, some intros. I'm Sam Sanders, campaign reporter here at NPR.
And I'm Tamara Keith. I cover the White House and the Democratic side of the presidential race.
And I'm Asma Khalid. I cover demographics and politics.
I'm Domenico Montanaro, political editor.
Okay, first up. So, Tamara, you guys talked a lot on the podcast earlier this week about Trump and how his rhetoric on Muslims and terrorism has changed the race. That was our episode Tuesday, if you missed it. But we have to counter-program a bit here because we don't want to do that thing that so many news outlets are doing right now, which is kind of all Trump.
All the time.
I mean, we were just discussing this, I think, even just in terms of what we want to talk about on the podcast. Is it so hard to talk about anything this election cycle without in some ways pivoting back to it?
And the thing that happens is if attention moves away from Trump, he says something big and outlandish, and then he sucks all of the oxygen out of the political universe, and all anybody's talking about is him. And here we are again.
Yeah, and look, some of the Republican candidates who are running against him have criticized the media. Some of the Democrats on the other side have criticized the media. I think a lot of people have had some criticism to say, you know, is this really the most important thing, especially when you talk about a ban on all Muslims, which is something that is not practical, it's not going to happen in Congress. All Republican leaders have come out to condemn it. So people wonder, are you just spending so much time on this one guy and giving him an even bigger platform?
Okay. So, Tam, you've been following Hillary. What's the latest with her?
For a long time, she joked about Donald Trump. She made jokes about his hair and her hair, and that changed. This week, her tone got very serious in Iowa, in Waterloo, Iowa. She said that what he's talking about, here we go again, talking about Trump, is not only shameful, but it's dangerous.
In terms of the comments about Muslims.
And her campaign announced that on Tuesday in Minnesota, she's going to deliver a big speech. They're drawing a lot of attention to it, to lay out a counterterrorism strategy that protects the U.S. homeland from terrorist attacks. She is going to specifically focus on trying to prevent radicalization of people here in America. And also, I would argue, probably trying to make a little space between herself and President Obama, who has been struggling to reassure people on the fight against ISIS.
Yeah, and there was also some interesting stuff from her on this in social media and in some email campaigns. There was a hashtag, was it Love Trump's Hate? And an email from one of her aides about being Muslim.
Huma Abedin.
Okay, what was that, Asma?
I mean, well, she sort of said, I think the subject line was, I'm a proud Muslim.
And this was who said that?
Huma Abedin, who's been one of Hillary's sort of closest confidants for many years. And it was a really sort of interesting subject heading, but then sort of went on to turn very quickly political. And I think in one of the emails, she was specifically asking people to buy those Love Trump's Hate bumper stickers, was it?
Yes.
For a dollar.
And the bumper sticker, so Hillary Clinton's campaign came out with this bumper sticker, Love Trump's Hate.
Which feels very gay marriage campaign to me.
Also, depending on how you emphasize the word, it could either be that you love Trump's hate or that love Trump's hate.
I love what Trump hates.
Exactly.
It wasn't a capital T, so I think if you're reading it, you understand that it wasn't a noun.
Thanks, Domenico.
Wow.
But when you're driving by real quickly on the side of the road, you know.
Right. But, I mean, I think Hillary Clinton went to your point earlier, Tam, about, like, needing to separate herself from Barack Obama and the speech that she's making on Tuesday when it comes to terrorism. I think that it puts her in a very difficult position when the president's polling numbers when it comes to fighting terrorism have been down over the past year since ISIS's rise. And I think that that's something that she's going to have to deal with. I think, though, that her hope is that someone like Donald Trump or even Ted Cruz, for that matter, that their policies get more attention and she can wedge herself between to the right of President Obama's policy and to the left of what she feels is an extreme view.
I feel like with all of this stuff, I see her less than the other candidates. Is she doing fewer appearances
She's doing public events. She's also doing fundraising.
Okay.
But the thing that, and that's behind closed doors. The thing I will say about her events, though, is they are generally speaking not designed to be exciting. They're not designed to be newsworthy. They're designed to get front page headlines in
those states.
In the local paper, in the Waterloo, Iowa.
Which is kind of an old strategy.
Yeah, because I feel like on cable news, I'm not seeing her as much as I am.
Yeah, but it's not a cable news primary for her. You know, when it comes to Republicans, it sort of is a Fox News primary. But I mean, you'll see Democrats, though. I mean, Bernie Sanders the other night popping up on MSNBC, just randomly stopping by to do an interview with Rachel Maddow. And that's the kind of thing that you'll see underneath. Unless you're watching MSNBC, because that's your audience, or because you're a Fox News watcher, if you're not watching those things in prime time when most of their audience is home from work and watching, you're not seeing this alternate primary that's going on.
Yeah. Hillary Clinton did go on Seth Meyers' show this week, but she is less exposed. And the other reason, just to get into a little media criticism here, is cable likes a horse race. And there isn't as much of a horse race. There aren't as many horses on the track on the Democratic side, and so the Democratic side of the race gets a lot less attention.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so much you can talk about. The one New Hampshire primary where Bernie Sanders is leading in a new poll over Hillary Clinton and is maintaining something of a lead over her, as opposed to where Hillary is doing well in Iowa and some of the southern states where she has what people think to be somewhat of a firewall.
Speaking of Bernie Sanders, I followed him around Baltimore on Tuesday of this week. He did a walking tour of the Sandtown neighborhood in Baltimore. This is a neighborhood where Freddie Gray grew up, and it was a neighborhood that had some rioting and looting after his death in police custody. So the most interesting tidbit of news from that day is, in fact, what Bernie chose not to really talk about. So he does his walking tour, swarmed by press and ministers. But after a closed-door meeting with black pastors, before a press conference, one of his press, actually his press secretary, Simone Sanders, who was of no relation to him, before the press conference, she gets on the mic, where she doesn't even know the mic's alive, but she says this.
Questions about the meeting, questions about Baltimore, why he came. If you want to ask about Chicago, we have a statement on Chicago that we put out a couple days ago, so you can definitely ask about Chicago. Don't ask about ISIS today. I mean, it's not on topic. So if it comes up and he wants to talk about it, the senator will let you know. But I appreciate if y'all stay on topic.
Y'all, when I tell you my jaw dropped, it hit the floor and rattled. I was just like, how in the world are you going to say that this week? Of all weeks.
Don't mean because it's ISIS, so much in the national consciousness, and it's what people are concerned about and want to talk about.
I mean, but it's just like concerns. You can't not talk about the number one issue running for president, right?
Am I wrong in saying that? Here's the thing. It's a misstep by someone on the campaign who doesn't quite realize what the media is going to talk about. And if you tell the media not to talk about something, that's the thing
as
the media is going to
talk
about.
We were tweeting about it, and then Bernie had this irate answer where he said, I'm not here today to talk about that. I'm talking about this impoverished neighborhood. We'll get to ISIS later, basically. And it felt weird.
And that's the thing about this Baltimore event is this was supposed to be a moment.
His moment, yeah.
Where he could walk through this community, talk about these issues that he's cared about for a long time and that he's been specifically working up a strong policy platform on. And instead, and his supporters would say, the mainstream media picked on this tiny little thing that happened and blew it out of proportion. And instead of the images of Bernie Sanders surrounded by
black pastors.
Surrounded by black pastors who support him. It's a story about Bernie Sanders getting angry because he doesn't want to talk about ISIS.
Well, you know what? That's a photo op. And I know campaigns want photo ops and they want things to look like they want them to look. But if you want to be president of the United States, you need to be able to articulate a foreign policy, because there are two things that presidents can really most directly impact. That's foreign policy and whether we go to war, and judges. You know, you can essentially put people on the Supreme Court. Essentially, they get through for the most part and in lower courts. But if you can't articulate a solid foreign policy, and when Bernie Sanders pivoted after two sentences in the debate immediately after the Paris attacks, I think there were a lot of people who were giving him a look, thinking he might be a serious candidate and questioning that.
Yeah. And I mean, so I was in New Hampshire this week as well, hunting for Trump supporters. But I ended up talking to three people, one Hillary supporter, one Trump supporter, one Bernie supporter. And over the course of our conversation, she, as a Bernie supporter, ended up talking about ISIS and Muslims, and it was a very important issue to her. And when she says he here, she's talking about Donald Trump.
I think what he wants is true. I mean, way he said, to just ban them from coming in the country for right now.
You think that's okay?
just for now. Like,
as a Bernie Sanders supporter, you think that's okay?
This is a Bernie Sanders supporter basically telling me I agree with Donald Trump's stance on banning Muslims from entering the country. And she was self-avowed, self-described Bernie supporter. Like, this is top issue for a lot of Americans. And if Bernie can't speak to it, it's going to hurt him.
But Bernie made it pretty clear in Baltimore. He'll talk about it a little bit, but he does not want to be sidetracked. He wants to talk about his economic agenda. And I've been digging through the tape, going back all the way to the 1970s, found a debate with the help of our stellar intern, Allie, where he largely said the same thing that he's saying now.
The fundamental issue facing us in the state is that one half of 1% of the people, the richest one half of 1%, earn as much as the bottom 27%, and the top 3% earn as much as the bottom 40%.
That was in 1976.
What we have seen in the last 10 years is the richest 1% of the population have seen an 86% increase in their real income, okay?
And that was 1991.
There is something profoundly wrong when the top one-tenth of 1% owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%.
And that was this year. The intensity is the same. The message is the same. The thing that has changed are the numbers.
Well, look,
meaning his level of support, you would say, has grown.
No. I mean, like,
the numbers about economic disparity.
Like, the 1% are even doing better now. That's all.
So, Ozma, we've got to pivot really quickly and talk about this new poll that came out with a lot of new data on young people and young voters, right?
Yep, that's right. It comes out twice a year from the Harvard Institute of Politics. They do these sort of wide-ranging, comprehensive looks at millennials, and they've been doing this, I believe, ever since 2000, when the earliest millennials came of age. And so they're looking at young people aged 18 to 29, and one of the sort of more interesting nuggets from this survey was the fact that a majority of people surveyed in the wake of the Paris attacks, supported the idea of American boots on the ground to fight ISIS.
Huh.
The sample size in this survey post-Paris is smaller, I should note that, but this is a question they have asked three times since April, and the pollster I was talking to suggested that over time he's seeing a hardening of support. It's really interesting, and this is a group of people 18 to 29 years old, perhaps a little younger than maybe the older bunch of millennials. Perhaps they don't have as much of a recollection, I would say, of the Iraq or the Afghanistan wars. But sort of the flip side of that also is they were then asked if they would actually want to volunteer or if they would serve themselves. And an overwhelming majority said no.
We're chicken hawks.
You said it.
I said it. I'm one of that group. I'm a millennial.
Well, but I think that they do probably mirror what the rest of the country looks
like.
Like,
this is just America, period, right? Like, Americans don't really
There has been a division between, Americans fighting in wars and being willing to go to war when they're not their sons and daughters. There hasn't been a draft in this country since Vietnam. You saw the results of that with protests in the streets because people had a real connection to it. People talk about the greatest generation coming out of World War II. That's because everybody knew somebody who was fighting in the war. That is not the America we live in. We live in an America where people go off and fight wars and, keep the country safe and free, that you might not have any idea, of a person who's gone to war.
I think the other thing to caution here is that this is all really fresh. Mm-hmm. We just had an attack on American soil, on a soft target, and we talked about this a lot in the other podcast, but there's a lot of fear. And the emotion is more raw now than it's been any time in the last decade.
And speaking of fear, I was in New Hampshire for about a day and a half, and I went to the Red Barn Diner in Manchester, New Hampshire. Thanks for the tip, Ozma. And I spoke with a guy, Jim O'Rourke, 81 years old, was in the Army 22 years, and he was talking about why he likes Trump. And it's a lot because of his stance on ISIS. And he told me that he has never been this scared before as he has been now for ISIS.
I fought in the Korean War, the Vietnam War. I have two Purple Hearts. But this time, I'm afraid for the whole country. I'm afraid for our kids, our grandkids, and everything else. What's coming?
And so because of that, he says that he supports all of Trump's stances on Muslims, on ISIS, and he supported the ban on Muslims, and I kind of pushed him on that.
How do you define who is or is not a Muslim? How would you define it?
Yeah, whether an individual is a Muslim or not?
Yeah.
Does he go to the mosque? Does he pray five times a day?
But, like, I'm a Christian. I don't go to church.
You know what the Muslims do. They have to.
Okay, so just a bit of truth squatting. I mean, I am Muslim. I grew up in a Muslim family, and there's a lot of different types of Muslims. There are your five times a day praying Muslims. There are your Muslims who show up on the big holidays at the end of Ramadan only. I mean, I think that this idea that every single Muslim is incredibly orthodox is just factually not true.
And we had this talk for like 20 minutes, and it made me realize, like, what Trump is saying, some people are saying it's out there, it's too far. But a lot of this stuff that he's saying makes a lot of sense for a lot of people.
People want, when they're scared, like a lot of people are feeling fear, they want something like bomb the expletive out of them, like Donald Trump says, or ban everyone because it's Muslims who are doing this, so let's keep them all out. That's a nice, easy way for people to feel like they think they know what's going on. And for a man like that, for his generation, they're used to wars that are state actors against state actors.
And they're wearing uniforms, you know, who to fight.
Right.
You know?
But, you know, this idea of terrorism that might be homegrown without even a link to another country, and there's no one to blame for it in a very easy way with very easy solutions, that's a very, very scary proposition for a lot of people.
All right, now it's time for Can't Let It Go, our weekly segment where we each talk about the one thing we cannot stop thinking about. Asma?
So the thing that I can't let go actually came out of the Harvard study that we've been talking about. It has really nothing to do with politics, but it was kind of an interesting nugget that was in there that kind of intrigued me. I know, Sam, so I don't know how you're going to feel about this, but because I know that you and I perhaps have a little bit different opinions about social media platforms,
okay.
In particular Snapchat.
Yeah.
And so I know everyone's talking about Snapchat and Snapchat and how. Thank you.
Sam doesn't get it.
That makes me feel better.
I'm on Snapchat, but I don't actually know how it works.
Like a Snapchat star.
The interns do it for me. Is
that
shout
makes
out to
me
the
feel
terms.
Better.
That's because you're not 20 years old.
I know, right?
So in this poll, they asked 18. So in this poll, they asked 18 to 29-year-olds, which of the following platforms do you have an account on? So number one, any guesses?
Instagram?
Facebook. Thank you. And everyone keeps saying that Facebook
is the outdated
thing.
Yeah, but
81%
everybody, but it's such a
people.
Behemoth, right? I mean, it's such a monster, you would think.
And
that.
If you're not
I
on
do,
it, you
but
feel
I guess
like you're
like
out.
The conventional wisdom that I keep hearing is that, like, oh, if you're 24, you know, you're not on Facebook because your grandma's on Facebook.
Yeah.
But seems like an overwhelming majority of them do have Facebook accounts. And so they sort of go through these different platforms. You know, Instagram does pretty well, Google Plus, Twitter.
Wait, Google Plus?
They're still asking about that?
No.
How many of them are
Google
on
Plus, 43%.
How many,
yes.
How many of them
well,
are
that's just because they have Gmail. No, see, the thing with Google Plus is they make you do it if you have Gmail. So, like, you're on Google Plus if you don't even know it, if
anyone,
you have Gmail.
Anyone in Prodigy chat rooms?
He's here all week.
So we go down the list, right? We go down the list, Instagram, Google+, Twitter, and then Snapchat.
Really?
36% say yes to Snapchat. And that is, like, nowhere near as high as what I have been hearing and thinking. So
do you think the Snapchat audience is actually even younger than that window? Because I know that very young people, like 13-year-old girls that I've met, or, you know, very young kids, they are communicating on Snapchat.
Wow. So the 18 to 29-year-olds are too old.
It might
Snapchat,
skew a little maybe. Too old for Snapchat.
I think food for thought. And if you use Snapchat, I would actually really love to know. So if you're listening and you have feedback for us and are like, hey, you guys are totally off base here with Snapchat, actually do let us know.
I think someone just tried to message us, but we missed it because it disappeared.
Yeah, but don't tell us over Snapchat because we will never find it.
You know, speaking of Snapchat, quick shout out. We do a weekly NPR Politics Snapchat on the NPR account about the meme of the week. So those who are listening and are on Snapchat, all three of you, check us out there on Fridays.
You are actually here to talk about the meme of the week, yeah?
Yes. So my Can't Let It Go this week was brought to my attention by our wonderful and amazing congressional correspondent, Susan Davis. She emailed me yesterday, day before, I was in New Hampshire for some Trump stuff. And she's like, oh my God, Sam, have you seen hashtag FLOTUS bars? And I was like, no, what's that? It is this trend that's taken off after First Lady Michelle Obama and an SNL cast member made a College Humor video where the First Lady raps, urging people to go to college. We have a bit of it right here.
FLOTUS on the track. Southside Chicago, we all know we had to do overtime every night to make it tomorrow. And everyone could really make their dream true. Hey, kid, listening in Michigan, that could be you.
You
I'm amazed at how she can carry herself. She can carry a rhythm, you don't think?
I mean, she's always had the moves. She can dance. Like, so, I mean, if you can dance, you can rap. But this is not great.
It's kind of like school pop. Right, I mean, it's like that, like the,
Kids Bop.
Yeah, kids. Oh. It's like Kids Bop.
Do y'all like it?
Yeah. Hey, you know, she's trying again.
She's trying. Yeah. She's having fun. You know what? Like, there's this thing. Like, don't make fun of people who are dancing because they're just like in it and they're having fun.
Yeah, except that when I saw myself in my wedding video, I think that's the last time I danced.
That is why I have not yet watched my wedding video, and it's been 10 years.
So this was not the extent of the rap. So once this rap video came out, Twitter had fun with the still image of the first lady behind the microphone, and the hashtag FLOTUS bars took off, and people made up lyrics for the first lady. A few of them were quite funny. There was one that said, "I'm Mama, Miss Obama, usually rock the Prada, First Lady Armada."
I think we need some beats.
No, we
can
don't.
We get some beats?
So I saw one from Susan herself. Did you see that
no,
one?
No, what did what? Susan do? Pull it up.
Oh,
pull
my
it
gosh.
Up.
Does anyone have their phone here? Susan's was good. It was about
it on Twitter?
Yeah, she posted it, and it was on having veggies.
Do you want to read it? Or
oh, Susan? No. Yeah, go
she,
ahead.
She says, here's mine. Eat my veggies from organic farms. Who needs guns when you got these arms?
I need to hear a little better.
Yeah, a little more.
Come harder with the Dominican.
Yeah. I'm sorry, it was a little too poetry. Is that yes. what you I'm not rapping this.
From the diaphragm. You got this. Try it again.
I'm not doing it.
Come on.
Domenico, what's yours?
Well, I know we had said at the top of this that we were going to try hard not to get to Donald Trump, but of course we did. And the thing that I have to tell you that I can't let go this week is the fact that Republicans are waiting and planning for a brokered convention. And I think that the rules are something that a lot of us who love the rules and love things like delegate allocation are going to start to get a lot of attention in the next couple months.
So define brokered convention for us.
Well, that's when there's a floor fight, essentially, at the convention. Convention's supposed to be sort of a beauty pageant where, you know, you show up and, hey, here's our guy or here's our woman, and they make their convention speech and, you know, they try to build momentum going into the general election. But it's really about delegates and votes. These are people who were assigned to that candidate based on the results in various primaries, and they all get together and they vote for that actual nominee. Now, what happened in 2008, for example, with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, because Hillary Clinton had conceded to Barack Obama, all of her delegates, she rallied them together and by acclamation said, "Let our nominee be Barack Obama." It was a nice moment of unity.
Yeah.
Now, that unity may not be what we see at this Republican convention if Donald Trump is still the guy winning a lot of these delegates.
So what happens in that scenario, like, really quickly?
Well, the big problem for Republicans that they changed this year is that they decided to bind a lot of the delegates to try to get a front runner a better chance of winning so that this thing didn't drag on for so long.
So that helps Trump?
That could help Trump if he winds up winning, you know, 20-25% of the vote that he's been getting, especially in a really big field. He could wind up going into convention with a quarter of the delegates already bound to him and, you know, with everyone else maybe not coalesced around another candidate.
So do you have your delegate spreadsheet ready to go at this point?
It is getting hot off the copier at this point. We are finalizing what the rules are in all of the states. We're talking about things like proportionality and thresholds of 15-20% and winner-take-all states and how those have changed. It's going to be so much fun.
I never want to hear superdelegates again.
So superdelegates don't exist on the Republican side.
Oh, good.
And we already know that the superdelegates on the Democratic side, that Hillary Clinton has a 45-1 advantage over Bernie Sanders, who's actually never been a Democrat. So he doesn't have the same ties that the Clintons do to the campaign.
Interesting.
Yep. Mm.
Interesting. All right. Tam, what's yours?
Mine is Serial, the mega successful podcast, is back.
Okay, can we not have spoilers? I haven't heard it yet, the first
okay,
episode.
I don't know what counts
everyone
as
dies
a
at the
spoiler.
End.
Oh, come on.
I'm kidding.
But I think that enough of it has been on cable news that nothing I'm going to say right now is truly a spoiler. But it is about Bo Bergdahl. As you might remember, he is this soldier who wandered off of his base in Afghanistan and was picked up by the Taliban, was held captive by the Taliban for 5 years. And then last year, the White House, President Obama, did a trade. There was a prisoner swap, 5 Guantanamo detainees for Bo Bergdahl. And what started out in theory as a positive story, the White House thought it was going to be a very positive story, almost immediately turned into a firestorm of controversy. And now Serial, the podcast, is going to dig deep, deep, deep into this. And as a White House correspondent, to me, it's fascinating because every week, the White House, this story that was supposed to be a good news story for the White House and then turned into a very complicated, not such a good news story for the White House, this is going to come back every week.
Now, was there a chance that the story unravels to be good for the White House or no?
Anything is possible. I mean, anything is possible.
Well, the fact that the White House is probably not all that thrilled with having to, you know, find out as a surprise every week what the potential news might be as everyone else downloads it, that's never fun for a White House press person.
So can I ask you just a real quick question?
Yeah.
I'm curious about this. Do you feel like from the first episode you've heard so far that there could be political implications, being that this is, you know, Bo Bergdahl's story is so tightly knit with the Obama White House legacy?
Absolutely. And
this could carry over to, say, sort of Hillary Clinton, or sort of what we'll see.
I don't know that it would necessarily carry over to Hillary Clinton, but anytime the president's ratings go down, that does hurt a Democrat.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this podcast is going to make his ratings go down, but I do know that the White House, based on the, you know, the promo inside the first podcast, the White House and its role in this is going to get some light shined on it.
Listen, it's a podcast. All right, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks for listening. And we want to remind you that you can hear a lot more of NPR's political coverage if you turn on your radio. Yes, your radio. Tune in to your local public radio station or stream us online. We're on NPR's Morning Edition and All Things Considered, talking about this kind of stuff all the time. Or you can also find us on Twitter. Let us know what you'd like to hear on the show. We're all there. I'm Sam Sanders, campaign reporter here at NPR.
I'm Tamara Keith. I cover the White House and the campaign.
And I'm Asma Khalid. I cover politics and demographics.
And I'm Domenico Montanaro, political editor.
We'll see you next time on the NPR Politics Podcast. Mm-hmm.